Right, I'm here actually at Jane Lindskold's house with Jane. If you want to say hi to everyone, Jane.
Hello, everyone.
And we are sitting at our kitchen table surrounded by cats, which I think is the perfect environment. Jane keeps apologizing for them, but I think they're great. So, Jane, you've got a lot going on right now. You've got quite a few irons in the fire. But let's first start talking about your collaboration with Dave Weber. Now, you've known Dave Weber for quite a while?
Forever. We met when I was going to conventions, actually, to meet Roger Zelazny, when we were first getting work underway on the biography I eventually wrote on him for Twain Publications.
This is on Roger?
On Roger. And there was a local bookstore that was having a book signing for David Weber, who was their only local writer. In Greenville, South Carolina.
Oh, okay.
And so Roger was going along as the guest of honor for the convention, and Steve White, who at that point was collaborating with Weber, was going along. And for some reason, Weber and I just hit it off like a house on fire. And we kept in touch, on again, off again, met up again at the next same convention the next year. And then one day, I get a phone call. He was coming up to a convention further north for him in my general neck of the woods. And he said, I get a phone call and says, Jane, my car just broke down. And I'm on the sign says I'm in Lynchburg, Virginia, which is where I think you live. And I said, yes, that's where I live. I'll come get you. And he told me afterwards that he expected me to, you know, direct him to a garage and then send him on his merry way. Instead, I took him home. He stayed for a week because his old Volvo, Lynchburg, Virginia, did not exactly have a terrific number of garages. So we all went off to the same convention together. And after that, we really were buddies. And when my first marriage broke up, Weber was definitely one of the people holding my hand when Roger had cancer. He was one of the few people who knew and was really helped me out. And, oh, funny things along the way. The bookstore's manager, where we met, the manager became his wife later on.
Oh, okay.
So we just kind of have stayed in each other's pockets. But except for me doing a couple of novellas for his Honor Harrington short story collections, I really had never done anything. And he called me up one day and he said, you really like YA, and you know I've wanted to do something with Honor's great, great, great Stephanie.
Is that what this is?
Yeah.
So the name of this book now that you're going to talk about is Fire Season?
It's Fire Season.
Okay.
And Fire Season is technically the second in the series. The first one, A Beautiful Friendship, Weber did as a solo because part of it is a novella he did many years ago for one of those collections.
Right.
And then he wrote a second part to it. And that one spans from when Stephanie's about 11 till she's about 14. Fire Season has a much closer, tighter focus. It picks her up shortly before her 15th birthday and covers less than 2 months, I think.
How much of it then is Weber's already created world, and how much of it was your
world has been created very tightly.
Okay.
The planet Sphinx, which is where Honor was born, he had worked out the backstory, and he had worked out the backstory of how the Harrington family lived there and everything. And he had done a few jaunts into the past. Where I'm coming in is a lot of, almost all the secondary characters are either mine or fleshed out by me.
Okay.
I'm doing an awful lot with tree cat culture. Mm-hmm. These are essentially alien first encounter books in many ways. In A Beautiful Friendship, Stephanie meets the first of the tree cats. And in Fire Season, we actually begin to see more of the backstory of their culture, how they live, how they interact. So for someone like me, who actually likes writing about non-humans, This was a really good fit.
So did you get to do a lot of the development of the True Cats, or was
mostly
it...
we have these great discussions. In fact, he sat at the other end of the same table, and I, you know, had a list for him of questions, and I sort of helped him firm up the kind of stuff that floats around in a writer's head,
right?
But the writer doesn't necessarily have put down into tight notes. I think he had a tremendous amount of material. But because of the context of the Honor Harrington books, which are 75% in outer space on ships, Tree Cat characters are isolated away from their main culture. They're lucky if they meet up with another Tree Cat who has been adopted by another member of the Navy, or vice versa, actually. The cats do the adopting, not the people. So I'd say it's sort of mutual. In the sense that I've made him firm up stuff that had been in there, but really just a tremendous font of enthusiasm. Weber is enthusiasm incarnate.
See, and I've never met
him. No, he's a 6'4" Cocker Spaniel.
Oh, okay. So what was it like actually working with him? Because sometimes, you know, getting along great as friends doesn't necessarily mean that it works well professionally when you're trying to do a creative project together. How did you find that transition?
I'm not a collaborator by nature. He is. So I dare say it's been a little harder on my side than on his side. And so there's no fault to him that I'm used to working solo and used to doing things my own way. And every so often I find it sort of frustrating that I'm held up by waiting for somebody else to provide me with material I need. But as far as feeling my opinions are respected, my ideas enthusiastically entertained, I feel very good about it. There was one point in Fire Season where we needed a group to be completely out of touch. And
you mean not have any communications?
No communications. Okay. And in the high-tech world he had already designed,
it's
really hard.
Really hard, yeah.
And so he would come up with a suggestion and I would say, no, I don't like it for this reason or that reason. And he just kept working with me and working with me and finally came up with just a brilliant solution. And so that's what I mean. I feel really not like he's going, hi, you're going to fill in the gaps.
Right.
In fact, even with a beautiful friendship, he said, he sent me the manuscript early and told me flat out he wanted my feedback because he felt that we were going to be working on the series together, so I needed to be comfortable with the foundation that was being put down. So, yeah, not a bully.
How many books altogether?
Well, right now we're contracted for Fire Season and its sequel, which I'm currently writing, The Tree Cat Wars. I know Weber, the Eternal Optimist, is certain will be offered more.
Which would be great.
I'm just writing the book I have the contract for and not worrying about the future, but Tigger is certain will be offered more.
And then when does Fire Season come out?
It comes out in October of 2012.
Okay, so just a couple months here.
Yep, and I was tickled. The first cover for A Beautiful Friendship is definitely Stephanie, but the cover for Fire Season is one of the characters I created, Jessica. So that was nice.
And a tree cat. Is this
and a tree cat? Yeah, I think that the one in the back standing on her shoulders is probably Stephanie's lion heart, and the one she's cradling in her arms is the one she will eventually become good friends with, who's called Valiant. He's wearing a respirator, which is why you aren't seeing a kitty
face. Yeah, I was going to say, I don't see his face.
Well, one of the things about writing about fires, you grew up in this area. You know what smoke is like. And oddly enough, I was writing Fire Season when the
During our fire season last year.
When smoke was billowing through Albuquerque and you couldn't see the sky, so...
Yeah. Not the kind of first-hand experience you want to have, but...
I used it.
Your writing process, since you're talking about how it is writing with David Weber, do you normally work with other people? Do you have a critique group, or do you tend to write on your own?
No, I'm a soloist. I started writing when I was finishing up grad school. I basically had always wanted to write, but I went straight from my undergrad work into my grad work.
And then what's your field academically?
I have a bachelor's, master's, and PhD in English Lit.
Okay.
So as I was finishing up my grad work, I literally kind of stood back and looked at my life, and I said, all right, there is a part of your life here that has been completely absorbed with classes and writing a dissertation and everything else. That's over.
Mm-hmm.
Plug the writing in now before the rest of life
fills in all those gaps.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I pretty much wrote the last lines of my dissertation and picked up a pen and started writing fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point I was living up in New York, in the Bronx. I went to Fordham.
Mm-hmm.
And about, I defended my dissertation in September. Did various odd jobs, teaching mostly, but, you know, adjunct professoring, mm-hmm. stuff like that, while I job hunted. And I was lucky enough to land a full-time assistant professorship, visiting assistant professorship, at a small college in Virginia for the following year. So, but during that time, I started writing fiction, and I never stopped.
And what drew you specifically to speculative fiction?
It's the way my brain works.
Yeah.
It's the only answer. I was a myth junkie from the time I was really small, and spec fic fits.
Mm-hmm.
I find it much harder to write. I've done historical fiction. Mm-hmm. I've done occasional mystery piece. But on the whole, my brain more naturally works in a world where... animals might talk with you and gods walk in the door than in a world that denies those aspects. So it's my reality.
Did you start in fantasy or science fiction?
Actually, that's a really good question. The first story I had published was a short story, and I guess technically would be called fantasy. It was in an anthology called Dragon Fantastic and called Between Tomatoes and Snapdragons, and had to do with... A woman who plants a snapdragon next to a tomato plant and gets a dragon egg.
No, that would be cool.
Yeah, and I still plant tomatoes next to snapdragons every year just because.
Yeah.
But when my first novel came out, it was one of those hybrids.
Okay.
And almost every review said, this book has fantasy on the spine, but it's actually science fiction.
Oh, okay.
And it's a sort of... cyberpunky science fiction, except my main character talks to inanimate objects.
Uh-huh. And doesn't have a psychotic disorder?
She has been diagnosed as autistic.
Oh, okay.
And by the way, I was writing this long before autism was a household word, with every parent on the planet wondering if their kid had some variation on an autistic spectrum disorder.
But
if you read the book, you'll see that the answer is quite a bit more complicated.
Sure.
But she thinks she's crazy and is quite content with it because she's been told she was crazy all her life.
Mm-hmm.
So science fiction or fantasy? Talks to inanimate objects?
It's one of those, like you say, a hybrid.
Yeah. The second book that came out, Marks of Our Brothers, was Alien First Encounter, very much definitely science fiction. But The Pipes of Orpheus was a sequel to the Orpheus myth, essentially.
Oh, okay.
I was teaching a course on mythology, and one of my students said to me, Dr. Linscold, I just don't get this Orpheus guy. And as I was explaining about Orpheus, I found myself thinking, what if he didn't die?
And didn't, but does he still look back?
And
did he look back, but he survives after?
Well, no, in the original myth, he looks back. It doesn't do anything to him. He doesn't get back.
Yeah, that's how he loses his wife, and then he kills himself.
No, the Maenads, the dedicates of Dionysus, tear him to shreds.
Okay.
So I thought, well, what if he didn't get torn to shreds?
Right.
What if, in fact, he's lived and then I set the second part of the book in a nebulous medieval Transylvania. And it's amazing how well vampire myth and the myth of Orpheus mesh.
I wouldn't have ever thought to put those two together.
I have a very weird brain. And that's why I write speculative fiction, right. Because it all makes perfect sense to me.
And so do you normally write entirely on your own? Do you seek any kind of feedback, or do you pretty much
close the door? And... I write my first draft on my own. My husband, Jim, has gotten extremely used to being asked questions in which there is no context provided.
Right.
I'll say something like, I need your opinion on a type of firearm, but I can't tell you why, because it would mean too much explaining. And then he very patiently pulls out his firearms books, or his archaeology books, or whatever, and provides me with an answer. But I really try not to pollute his mind stream, because he's my first reader. And he has full permission and now takes it to say whatever the heck he wants. And then I usually solicit, depending on how tight my deadline is, a couple of people to read what for me is complete. But I until it's done, nobody but me sees it.
Okay. So you do that sort of that one round of feedback and then it's off to the publisher.
Yeah. And my rule for myself is if I disagree with someone's feedback, I don't take it. But if I hear the same complaint or comment or critique from a second person, then I decide the problem is mine and that I'm not as clear as I think I am.
Sure.
And then I take it very seriously.
So do you think you developed this method of working because of how you got into writing? Were you pretty much on your own when you started?
Always. In the world of, in the academic world, really science fiction and fantasy is still not terribly well accepted.
Sure.
So being in an academic context, I certainly wasn't going to find a lot of peers who were writing this stuff. Though I must say, the college I taught at for 5 years, Lynchburg College, was wonderful. They didn't care what I was writing. They were tickled when I sold something, and very supportive. I sold my first several novels while I was working there, and they were just as nice as could be about it. And it was sort of like, yeah, we've got this lady who teaches modern British lit
And
composition and write science fiction on the side, and isn't that amusing?
So were those sales the ones to Avon?
Yeah.
And so you got started actually selling and working as a writer while you were still working as an adjunct?
No, I was a visiting assistant then an assistant professor during that time. So I just pursued two careers side by side.
Did you have much contact with the rest of the speculative fiction community?
But oddly. That same year I was mentioning where I decided to plug up the holes in my schedule with writing, I also wrote a letter to Roger Zelazny, who I'd never met, and essentially pointing out to him some interesting potential alternates in his Amber series. I knew nothing about the business, and suggesting that it would be very interesting. It wouldn't change his basic canon at all, but to write something from the point of view of some of the other people who were seeing the action from a different point of view. And he sent me back a very polite postcard. I later found out that was how he always responded to fan mail he thought was worth responding to. He'd send a postcard because it didn't take too much time to do one. And I thought about it, and I wrote him a thank you note. And he wrote me another postcard. And then I wrote him another note. And we kept corresponding. And just back and forth. I still have a file drawer full of letters. I mean, I met him finally, well, not finally, a few months later. He was guest of honor at a convention in Tarrytown, New York, which is outside of New York City. And me and some of my buddies went up to it. I'd never been to a science fiction convention before. I thought it was more like an academic conference. I walk in the door. The first thing I see is two girls dressed in fur bikinis and live ferrets.
Yeah.
And if I had been driving and not one of my buddies, I think I would have turned around and walked right out the door then.
Well, I'm glad you didn't.
But instead we stayed, and I very politely waited until Roger had one of his enormous lines of people, and I went got to my place in the line, and I said very shyly, Mr. Zelazny, because I didn't know how it was pronounced, I'm Jane Linscold. And he'd been looking at my hands for where's the book I'm supposed to sign.
Sure.
And then he looks up, and he said, oh, it's you! You came! And he told me afterwards he was completely surprised because of the surname. He'd been imagining a big, strapping Nordic blonde. Uh-huh. And it just took a moment for the mental image and all to connect.
Uh-huh.
But to make a long and twisted story short, we were chatting there, but he had this line snaking across the room.
Right.
So he popped up onto a chair and hollered for somebody because he knew his agent, who would later become my agent, was throwing a party that night, and he figured we'd get more time to talk.
Uh-huh.
At the party. So we'd been planning on going home that night, but we stayed, and I went to the party with my ex-husband, and now ex-husband, not then.
Mm-hmm.
And Roger and I just, it was like, you know, one of those snakes.
Mm-hmm.
Roger and I'd be talking, a third party would come and interject themselves into the conversation, and then someone else would drag Roger off, and then Roger kept coming back.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time we were done with that weekend of just visiting, we were both hooked, and
mm-hmm.
the letters got longer and longer and longer and longer and longer.
And is Roger how you ended up in New
Mexico?
Yeah.
Contrary to what a lot of people automatically assume, I did not move. My marriage would have broken up anyhow.
Sure.
I got married right out of college, and sometimes just the chemistry that works well when you're in college
right.
doesn't work well afterwards.
Uh-huh.
And Roger and I at that point were corresponding a lot and talking on the phone occasionally, and I came home one day, and things were just untenable. And
mm-hmm.
I said to myself, that's it.
Right.
I've got another term. I will use the term to job hunt, and I'm going.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, I told Roger, and he really surprised me. He said, rather than just going anywhere, would you come here? And that
yeah.
was literally the first time we had ever talked about it. We were both quite conscious of the fact we were madly in love with each other, but we
mm-hmm.
neither of us were the kind of people to break up marriages. He had
sure.
kids,
mm-hmm.
etc. We talked about varying places, decided that two of his kids were still in high school, didn't want to take them out of, you know,
sure.
take their dad away.
Sure.
So that even though it would be more difficult for me,
mm-hmm.
I'd move into his turf.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was supposed to move out that spring, and as he told it to me afterwards, he decided that if I had the guts to drop everything and move across country to a city I'd visited once,
mm-hmm.
that he could at least go to the doctor.
Oh, okay.
And he found out he had cancer.
Right.
And so I delayed my move out for a couple of months so he could get a few things underway, like chemo and
mm-hmm.
stuff like that. And then I came out here fully knowing.
So was that the battle cancer that ended his life?
Yeah,
okay.
We had 11 months.
Wow. So.
I moved out June of 1994, and he died.
Uh-huh.
Not even 12 months in June of 95, he'd already bought me an anniversary present.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So rough. But I stayed. I'm anticipating a potential question.
Yeah.
I stayed because the writers' community out here was really nice.
Uh-huh.
And it was fun living somewhere after all those years of having to explain the ground rules
right.
of writing.
Uh-huh.
It was really nice being in an area where I could talk about a publisher or an agent.
Right.
And people, I didn't have to explain what they were.
Mm-hmm.
David Weber came out for Roger's memorial, and with firm instructions from the woman he would later marry to make sure she has a support system. If she doesn't, pick her up, bring her back, we'll take care of her.
Wow.
I told you, we're buds.
Yeah.
And But Weber felt I had the support system, and indeed, I'm still damn fond of just about everybody out here.
Yeah, so you've been here ever since, basically. Yeah. And then have you had any other day jobs since moving out here? You've been supporting yourself in writing?
Yeah, great. And I have always supported myself. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, my one moment of feminist flag waving. Mm. But even these days, you run into people who assume that if you're a woman and if you're a writer, it's really the guy who's paying the bills.
Right.
And Jim and I got together, and
this was your house before.
This was my house
before he came along. And
mind you, he has put enough work into it that it's definitely his house. But, you know, I actually told him I insisted on drawing up a sort of division of bill paying.
Uh-huh.
Because I said, I am not going to fool myself into believing I am a writer.
Right.
When I'm really a dilettante whose hubby supports her while she dilettantes around.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one point when Avon dumped me and I was looking for a new publisher that I seriously thought about going out and getting a job. And Jim looked at me and said, I really believe in you as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
Would you give me 6 months or a year where I support you, because I firmly believe you're going to find a new publisher and everything's going to be fine? And I told him I'd think about it. Before I had to think about it, I did find...
You found a new publisher.
A new publisher. In fact, sold the first of the Firekeeper books.
And so let's talk a little bit about all the books you've written over the years. Mm-hmm. You started out with Avon.
Right.
And the books you wrote for them, how many were they? Roughly 8-ish?
6, 7, 8, something like that.
And
yeah.
Are they part of a series or...
No.
They're
all separate.
Okay.
I like series, but I also like standalones.
Uh-huh.
And early on, the editor I was with, John Douglas, was also sort of interested in the standalone thing.
Uh-huh.
And then part of the reason Avon and I didn't continue to work out is he shifted houses.
Oh, okay.
And the people I was working with thereafter, fine people, but we didn't gel in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
So I unintentionally wrote a sequel to a book that I hadn't intended to write a sequel to, and that was, I wrote Changer, and then I wrote Legends Walking,
mm-hmm.
and that was my last book for Avon.
Okay, and then, so that backlist you now own the rights to again,
I do.
And you've been talking about maybe e-publishing?
Yes, Changer and Legends Walking, which is now available as its original title, which was Changer's Daughter.
Uh-huh.
But I make it very clear
it's the same
on the
book.
Blurb that it's the same book.
Uh-huh.
But it is actually the ebook has some neat bonuses. I wrote introductions for each one talking about where they came from.
Uh-huh.
And for Changer's Daughter, I included the one Athanor short story I wrote.
Oh, okay.
Because I thought that would be nice, and it's very hard to find now.
Yeah, and that's one of the neat things about e-publishing is the ability to put in those kinds of extras that, you know, personal touches by the author like that.
Yeah, well, I thought that if people wanted the book, they could, they might appreciate
mm-hmm.
a little bit of extra for their kindness.
Sure. And then, so then you moved on to write for Tor.
Right.
And one of the series you're most famous for nowadays is the Firekeeper series.
Yes.
And so did you immediately start with the Firekeeper series?
I did.
Them? And then
I did. And this is sort of an example of not giving up and being tenacious.
Uh-huh.
While I was still with Avon, John Douglas, my then editor, was, you know, saying, let's think about a series. And mm-hmm. then he left, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But I had been thinking about the ideas, and I came up with a handful, and I'm sort of wolf-obsessed. My mother says, have been since I was a small child.
Yeah, you've got pictures of yourself with wolves on your website.
Yes. I mean, really, but it people say, well, when did you fall in love with wolves? And the answer is, I think I was born that way. So doing something with wolves had a lot of appeal for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote a proposal, and you know, sample chapters, and my agent would send it out, and we would get a rejection, but I kept writing. I kept writing, and finally we had a finished book, and it was not short. And at that point, my agent was kind of at the beginning of building her relationship with Tor, and the story I heard from Teresa Nielsen Hayden, who was the editor from that series, is that Patrick Nielsen Hayden, her husband and senior editor for the, the line, came into her and said, Kay McCauley sent us something. Would you take a look at it?
And Kay is your agent.
Yeah, Kay is my agent. And Teresa said she took this enormous stack of paper and she came back and she read it and she came back and thumped the entire 800-something pages in front of Patrick and said, I want more, which is awfully nice.
And the rest is how many books now?
Six.
Six books. In the
Six books. And each of and some of them got quite fat. The last one got really fat because by then I could see the handwriting on the wall and I wanted to tie up as many loose ends as I could.
Right. And then what else have you written for Tor over the years? Quite a few standalones.
Two standalones, I think. The Buried Pyramid, which is an archaeological adventure fantasy set in 1870s
Now,
Egypt.
Was that based on a role-playing game? That was another local rumor that it was based on an RPG.
It sort of was. What happened is it went like this. I came up with an idea for the book. And was noodling around with it, and then Kay said, you know, the equivalent of, oh, but we've got so much else in line, and then Avon dumped me. And I thought, well, I'm probably never going to be able to do this book. At that point, I was gaming with the local gaming crew, George Martin and Linda Snodgrass and Walter, and the guy I later married, Jim Moore. And I said, you know, I've got this wealth of material. How about I turn it into a game? And so I ran it for them for a game. But
Okay, so it started as a book idea, became a game.
Right, because I didn't think, at that point I didn't have the confidence I do now that eventually an idea would, would blossom forth. And we'd gotten, you know, at that point, it had been rejected, and so I thought it was never going anywhere. And so I ran the game. And then I forget whether I was still running the game or had just finished it when the movie The Mummy came out.
Okay.
And I got this series of phone calls from people in the gaming group going, Jane, Jane, they've made a movie of your book! Because there were some, you know... Some similarities, especially, oddly enough, in a lot of the characters. That was the weird thing. Anyhow, time went on, and my relationship with Tor got established, and Kay, my agent, came to me and said, we're negotiating another contract. Can I try them on the Egypt book? I really love that book. I really believe it could go somewhere. So I was surprised. I'd been thinking of it as dead weight, and I said, sure, but... I'm going to need to do some rewriting because there was one character I really liked in the book who I cannibalized parts of him for Darien in the Firekeeper books. He would have been too much, would have been too much to have a character that similar to Darien. So I said, yes, but give me a time to recraft this. I've learned a hell of a lot over the last couple of years.
Sure.
And so it was that later version that... Tor bought.
That's too funny because now there's two books that have come out of the local gaming group.
Mm-hmm.
Buried Pyramid and then Leviathan Wakes.
Which is great.
Which,
yeah,
it's up for the Hugo this year. That's too funny. It's because it's pretty much the same group of people.
And I think a similar thing. Ty was running his game.
Yep.
And and the game wasn't going much of anywhere, but Daniel said, you've got a great universe here, man. Let's play with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they've taken
I really like it. I'm looking forward. I haven't read the sequel yet, but I will.
I've only read the rough draft, but...
No, I was very enthusiastic about Leviathan Wakes.
Yeah.
And then my other standalone for Tor was Child of a Rain.
Which is one of my favorite books of all time.
Thank you. This is where an extraordinary editor can be a real gift to a writer. The idea for Child of a Rainless Year came to me out of the blue. Literally. I still to this day have no idea where that book came from. And I wrote the first several pages and had one of my rare conference calls with Teresa Nielsen Hayden. And I said, by the way, Teresa, while I've got you, you know, the current contract is a firekeeper and one to be named later. I think I have the to be named later. Except I have no idea what it is, where it's going, or what it's going to be.
Because it is, it's a almost a magical realist sort of a plot.
That's what I was trying for. It's very hard for Americans to write magical realism because we don't have that cultural background. We want to explain everything.
Though New Mexico's got a bit, I think, of an edge in that sense.
And so I read Teresa what I had on the computer, and just over the phone, and she said, great. I'll take it. By the way, you do know what you read me as the first section is actually the second section, and the other one is the first section. And I said, it is. I'll think about it.
So it used to be in chronological order?
No, or? It was literally just the first couple very short sections. And the other thing she said is, oh, wow, liminal space. And at that point, I didn't even know much about the term. But I mentioned it to another wanting to set it in Las Vegas, New Mexico. And another person said that, so I went and did research and realized, yeah, I didn't know the term, but I sure was, I was fascinated with the concept. So I kept trying to explain to Teresa that I really thought I had a book there. She said, we've done several books together, Jane. I'm used to the fact that you never know where you're going and you always get there.
Oh, wow.
Just write the book.
Great.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, so I was very, you know, very sorry to lose Teresa when her health wouldn't let her continue editing. Because she really had, we had very good creative chemistry, and I liked that a lot.
Yeah, she's a fantastic line editor. I've seen her do her party trick where she goes down the page, marks it all up, and you still sound every bit as much like yourself in half the space.
Yeah, she did very little of that for me, actually.
Well, probably you've got quite a lot more experience doing that for yourself.
But she, she was wonderful at content, thought, understanding the soul of a story. One of the things that really made me certain that we were going to have a good relationship was there was one scene in the first draft of the Firekeep of Through Wolf's Eyes that I wasn't happy with. Jim had read it, he had no problem. David Weber had read it, he had no problem. Steve Sterling had read it, he had no problem. A couple other people, no problem. Every time I'd even, you know, let them finish the book, and then I'd say, what about this one scene?
Yeah, and they'd...
When Teresa called me up for an editorial conference, she said, on the whole, I love this book. The ending needs a little work, and there's one scene that just doesn't work, and it was the exact same.
So.
And I thought, okay, we're on the same creative wavelength. Fantastic.
And so, since writing the Firekeeper books, have you written any other series for Tor?
I did a three-book series called Breaking the Wall. And the first book is 13 Orphans. The second is 9 Gates.
It's kind of a stupid question because I did know, of course, about that series. But
Yeah, that was my other Tor series. And I really like them. I
came out right in the middle of a recession. Right at the beginning of a recession.
Literally came out within 2 weeks of the federal government finally admitting what a lot of us already knew, which is we were in a serious recession. But everybody chose to panic and decide that, you know. So the books got phenomenal reviews.
Well, a lot of writers didn't survive that.
Yeah.
Because book sales plummeted for quite a while there.
Yeah, and they're still struggling.
Yeah.
I mean, but I'm very happy with the books. I suspect that some of the material was a touch esoteric, but I can't help it. That's the way my brain works.
Sure. And so are they... are they out in ebooks as well?
I guess. Tor has e-rights for those books, and since they pretty much are following the e-revolution with a fine retro guard, I would say they are available as ebooks.
So they'll kind of always be available, even when they're stocked on bookstore shelves?
I hope so, and I have some of the hard copies, which people do need to get because the cover art is absolutely stunning, especially the first two books. Felt a little strange about the third book. Not the artist's skill, which still remains brilliant, but I really couldn't figure out why they did that. And also, I couldn't figure out why books with really strong characters, they chose to put simpering females on them. But
especially on Jane Linscold books.
Yeah, I mean, I don't do simper.
No.
But I loved his use, his depiction of anything mythic or Chinese. The dragon and tiger on the front of the first book is just fantastic. And then they put this simpering girl in a nightdress on the front. It's like, I don't know who she is, but she ain't in my book. That's, you know, one of the mysteries.
And that's, I think a lot of people don't realize that the authors and the cover artists usually don't have any contact with each other. And and publishers will even enforce that.
Yeah. Yeah, and I didn't have any for any of my tour books, except very indirectly a little with Julie Bell, and that was after somebody drew something to my attention where I thought her work might have been plagiarized.
Okay.
And I wanted to make sure that no one was using her work without her permission.
Sure. And then, so, aside from this series that you're working on with David Weber, what else have you got in the pike?
Well, I'm really kind of excited. I have a new project that the ink is not yet dry on the contract. In fact, I haven't yet inked the contract, so let's hope we don't jinx it.
Yeah.
it's going to be with Tor again, and I've got a two-book contract for what I hope will be longer than two-book series. The series is called Artemis Awakening, and Artemis is a planet.
Oh, okay.
And it's going to have... I always loved the science fiction where those lines between is this science fiction, is this fantasy, blurred. And I decided I was coming up with this project on my own, on my own impulse. I wanted to do something with animals again, but I had to come up with a completely different rationale for human-animal partnership. So a world that was deliberately crafted, and one of the things that was thrown into the mixing pot deliberately were occasional animals who make who are quite not your average bunnies.
Okay.
Because I love animals.
Sure.
I mean,
As we can tell, we've got how many cats
around
us right now?
Yeah, we had three a moment ago. Yeah. Though I think Persephone and Kel just went to chase each other. And four guinea pigs out in the yard, and indoor fish and outdoor fish. To me, I have to admit, a lot of writers write worlds with no animals. They write worlds with people without children. I am the eldest of four kids. I can no more, even when I write a book like Child of a Rainless Year, where the character is ostensibly an orphan, by the end of the book she's discovered she has this huge interconnected family. To me, worlds without either family connections or animals are as dead and dry and dull as anything I can imagine. But sometimes you have to come up with reasons.
Sure.
Because most people don't think that way.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty excited. I wrote 250, 300 pages or so on spec before it was sold. And then I had to go off and write Fire Season, and, or actually I'd finished Fire Season, but I had to go write Tree Cat Wars, so I'm quite eagerly awaiting getting done with Tree Cat Wars and sending that off to Weber for him to monkey with so that I can go back to my people.
So do you don't, it's far too early to think of release dates for these?
Probably, though I would hope that we don't have to wait too long, but my luck has never been that way. I sold my first four books to Avon before the first one came out.
Okay.
I had four books, and unconnected books. It wasn't like the thing where you hear it all the time, a publisher waits till the author's written book one and book two.
Right.
Because they don't want to get stuck.
Right.
No, I had four unconnected books.
Uh-huh.
By contrast, David Weber, who, like I said, we were both getting started about the same time, had Bain Books putting out his books bang, 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 you know, 6 to 9 months apart. And then when I started with Tor, it was the same thing. I had, Through Wolf's Eyes was already written, but they had bought four books before Through Wolf's Eyes ever came out, even though it was written, Teresa did her editing, and then it just, you know, sat.
So they took their time to actually get it out and put it on shelves.
And so my general philosophy is that's where things kind of go beyond my control.
Sure.
I would hope and pray that I do not have to wait until I'm 60 to yeah. see these books come out.
Well.
But.
That's quite a ways off for you still, or no?
I've got a decade.
Speaking.
I've got a decade.
I was going to say, it looks like more than a decade sitting across the table here from Jane.
Thank you kindly.
So.
So, I don't know the release date.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to try and turn in the first manuscript sometime early next year, 2013, since I've got a big chunk of it written already.
Sure.
And
then do you still do any short fiction or anything else that...
Yeah, I just did a novella for a Man Kazin War anthology that just came out.
Uh-huh.
When I was in college, anyone would have asked me, where, if you could live in any fictional universe, would it be? I wanted to be a single ship miner in known space.
Sure.
I mean, that was my idea of heaven.
Uh-huh.
Universe full of aliens, where you didn't have to be in the military to
mm-hmm.
go out there and adventure in outer space. I loved it. So
mm-hmm.
when a friend came to me and said, I don't know if you'd be interested, but I've been asked to sound out a few people, it's like, okay, Man Kazin War's not my favorite time period, then absolutely cannot resist. I get to write a story with Kazin in it.
Mm.
Though I have to admit, the puppeteers are my favorite.
Yeah, the puppeteers are very cool.
Oh, I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
Three
legs and two heads. And
and chronic cowardice.
Yeah.
And it all makes sense.
Uh-huh.
I just
yeah.
love it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I couldn't resist. And I'm trying to think. I'm sure there's something else. I've had a couple of short stories out. But, you know, the short story markets have really dried up.
Yeah.
And with the death of Marty Greenberg...
Mm.
I don't get nearly as many opportunities. I used to get a half dozen or more invitations a year out of there.
Sure.
And I don't get those anymore because that venue isn't there. But by God, if I ever publish a great big fat short story collection, it'll be dedicated to Marty.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
he believed in my stuff. My first submission to him was cold.
Mm-hmm.
And he believed in my stuff long before anybody else was willing to take a gamble. So
yeah,
I hope he's a star in heaven somewhere.
Yeah. But the next thing that people will see from you will be Fire Season.
Fire Season.
In October.
Mm-hmm.
Being released from Tor.
Bane.
Okay, so this one's coming out from Bane.
Mm-hmm.
And beautiful cover.
I like it.
Here.
I like it.
And do you think I'd be able to get a copy of the cover art to put on the Blackgate site?
Sure. I can give you
a JPEG? Oh, okay. Yeah, I can scan it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm sure Bane would give you a JPEG.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Great. Well, thank you very much, Jane.
Thank you for letting me babble.
No, hardly. Thanks very much.